Welcome back to In the Moment. I'm Lori Walsh. We're going to try to talk to Laura Shapiro again. She is a James Beard Award-winning author. Her new book is called Six Remarkable Women and the Food That Tells Their Stories. Laura, can you hear me?
Yes, I can. Hi.
Let's get started. Tell me how you began writing about women and food.
Well, it had occurred to me that when I read a biography, you never knew what anybody ate. It's as if these people never had breakfast, lunch, or dinner. Well, you know they did. And why wasn't the biographer telling you about that? To me, that would have been the most interesting and revealing part of their lives. I now know that one reason we don't read about food in people's lives so much is that biographers can't find the material. People don't write it down. It's not in their memoirs and letters. And another reason is that traditionally biographies were written about important people who were too important for us to think that they thought about food at all. Food was something kind of lowly and uninteresting and associated with women and housework and all kinds of awful things that did not belong in a serious biography. So the result was that that whole kind of part of life dropped out of the telling of a life story. So I wanted to put it back.
Tell me why you think that female life at the stove or at the table, as you write, really matters. Like, what do we gain from knowing this stuff?
Well, you know, when the women's movement was kind of in flower during the 70s and women's studies started to come along and there was a lot more interest in women's history, I looked around and I could see that a lot of people were working on books about, say, women in politics or women in power, women in education. Nobody was writing about women in food. It seemed to me that what went on in the kitchen, where women spent so much of their lives, it had to be important just because so much of life went on there. The food that they could bring into that kitchen, those choices were dictated by politics and economics and their social history and their cultural history and their class, and as well as all the agricultural and all the other food issues circulating around them. So it just seemed to me if you could look at the food in that kitchen and relate it to the woman, you would really see something. And that's what I tried to do.
So tell me about the six women in the book. Who did you decide to feature, and how did you choose those particular women?
Well, it's kind of a motley crew. I have included Dorothy Wordsworth, who is the sister of William Wordsworth, the poet, Rosa Lewis, who was a Victorian and Edwardian caterer, a woman who was a scullery maid, working class, with a Cockney accent. She used food to climb up the social ladder till she was accepted by all the rich and noble of her time. Eleanor Roosevelt, who was kind of famous for having no interest in food, but what I discovered was she, in fact, had an appetite. She, in fact, had a capacity to enjoy food. I have Eva Braun, who was Hitler's mistress, who represents in this book the power of food to kind of cast a warm, sentimental glow around the table, even when the people around the table are Nazis and what's going on outside is the most horrific destruction of the 20th century. And I have Barbara Pym, a wonderful British novelist whose books are full of food and tell you an enormous amount about the life, a woman's life in Britain after World War II. And Helen Gurley Brown, obviously the longtime editor of Cosmopolitan, whose approach to food was basically to resist eating it as much as possible.
Right. How difficult was it to find the kind of research and information, those sort of breadcrumbs along the way that would help you tell the full food story of these women?
It was difficult in many cases. Some of them have a huge paper trail, like Eleanor Roosevelt. You know, there are whole libraries dedicated to Eleanor Roosevelt, and there was a huge amount of material that I could go through. Someone like Eva Braun left very little personal documentation. We don't have much from her own hand, but she was at the center of in a place and a time that was very much written about and recorded while it was going on, and of course by many, many historians since then. So you can pull it out. If you kind of read around her, you can pull the material out. Helen Gurley Brown was an interesting person to do the research because her papers are all at Smith College in boxes and boxes of documents that she gave them. She just gave everything away. It's like she never tried to hide anything. And you go through those papers, and the most amazing visions come of this, you know, very interesting young woman, ambitious and smart, sort of dedicated her life to remaining young and sexy long after the time when most women would have put those goals away. She kept it going. But you see all this happening in her archives. So, as I say, some of them had plentiful archives, and some I had to really poke around and keep looking for.
And sexy to her means skinny to Helen Curley Brown. Those two are inseparable.
Yes, yeah, there's no difference between that. She said, you know, to be fat, what did that mean? It meant that, you know, one tiny fraction of an inch bigger around the waist, to her, that was fat. Her whole idea was that women could do anything they wanted, be anything they wanted, climb as high, do anything. But none of it meant anything unless there was a man in her life. And there was only one way to get a man in your life. That was to be skinny and sexy. If you weren't those things and you didn't get the man, it didn't matter who you were or what you did, your life was useless.
Was she the same person privately as she was in this public way? Is that how she really felt? Or was she selling magazines at that point and sort of putting a persona forth to the world?
I think she felt it. I think that's what I mean was so interesting about going through her own papers there. It's like when she started out, she was this lively, smart young woman, went to Los Angeles to make it and really prove herself in the big city, and she was extremely successful. She made money. She did very well. When she married David Brown, a movie producer, she felt that was like the crowning achievement of her life, and it was the thing that validated her as a woman. And that was such a powerful part of her identity that she really did sell it to all other American women in the pages of Cosmopolitan. You can be like me. I was really skinny and sexy, and I won this wonderful man. You can do it too. It was a way to sell magazines, but I think she sold it to herself as well.
Wow. So tell me, a book like this, and if you're just joining us, the book is called What She Ate. The author is Laura Shapiro, and we're talking about just one chapter one woman that's featured out of six, Helen Curley Brown, editor of Cosmopolitan. And I'm wondering, Laura, what do we, when you've done your research on her and we read this chapter, how does that change how we then relate to her as a woman in history? And then let's sort of expand that to some of the other women as well.
I think that you maybe feel a little more sympathetic towards her because of how she was clearly a prisoner of her, of those beliefs. It was kind of heartrending to me to write the end of that chapter where she's being interviewed by Gloria Steinem, who's a woman she has tremendous respect for, and Gloria, to her credit, has respect for Helen Curley Brown because she knows that there's a great businesswoman and a smart person under the wig and the plastic surgery and the skinny body. And she sees a real person of substance. So she says, Helen, tell me something good about yourself, something important, something that shows us what kind of person you are, how we should take you seriously. And Helen thinks about it. She says, I'm skinny. It's all she can come up with.
Oh, wow.
It was, I feel like, you know, as a feminist, I did not have high regard for her or for Cosmopolitan, but the fact is, once you know her life, you know, you can reach out a hand and kind of get closer to that person, and you have some sympathy. This was not the case in all of them. Ava Brown, obviously, I did not become any closer to her once I learned what she ate. And in fact, it was, as you can imagine, difficult to write that chapter in many ways. Right. You're spending a lot of time with a really horrible person. But I chose her because I thought if food could tell me something about this very mysterious, kind of unknowable person, then I was right. You really can use food as a tool in biography. If it can get you any closer to Helen, to Ava Brown, then it really is helping you in some way. And sure enough, we don't know much about Eva Braun. There isn't much written there's a great deal written. There isn't much about the food. We know that she ate lightly because she wanted to keep her figure appealing for Hitler, but she wasn't a crazed dieter like Helen Gurley Brown. What we really know about her was that she lived in a bubble, that she protected herself from fully seeing or knowing about what was going on around her. She knew it perfectly well, but she protected herself from having to deal with it, from her own conscience, from what passed for her heart and moral core, if she had those things. She was completely shielded. I use champagne not only as a real thing, which it was, but as a metaphor. It's like she lived in a champagne bubble. These Nazis were drinking champagne all the day and night. There was tons of it had been plundered from France. It came in all during the war, and they drank it all the time. And she drank it as they all did. And my image of her is that she just created this bubble of sweetness and celebration and life. She dressed up in beautiful fashions. She was a photographer. She took pictures of everybody. She loved living on the surface of things. That's where you stayed if you didn't want to go deeper, if you didn't dare to go deeper, if you were afraid what you were going to see if you went deeper. So that's what I learned about Eva Braun. As I say, it didn't make me one whit sympathetic. No, she didn't cook.
She didn't cook.
She didn't have to. She had a maid, and there is no evidence that she ever cooked. She liked thinking of herself as sort of the first lady and the hostess and the person in charge, but there were flocks of servants doing all the work.
So speaking of first lady, really interesting stuff about Eleanor Roosevelt and you know, sort of her embarrassment about what her husband's appetites are and then her own disregard for food. Tell us more about that.
Yes, the relationship, the food story for Eleanor is very much a food story of their marriage, which was full of difficulty. He had this affair, and that was just a huge crushing blow to Eleanor. They stayed together, but to her it was not a marriage after that. It was a political partnership, and she respected it as a political partnership, but she was not happy in it. And, of course, she took her life as First Lady and became one of the great beacons of women and feminism of the 20th century. But it wasn't something that she had chosen. And the food came to represent all that. He asked her to take charge of the domestic side of the White House, and she did that. She put in place a housekeeper who was completely inept, who could not in any way do the enormous job of running the kitchen for this very public place. But she did have that job. Food was terrible, in part because the budget was low, because it was the Depression, and they wanted to keep that kitchen on a very economical basis. But
story about Ernest Hemingway coming to dinner or lunch, and finding out that you're supposed to eat before you go to the White House. Tell us a little bit about how that reputation spread.
Well, what happened in Hemingway's case was that. He was going to the White House, and they were flying there, and they were waiting for with his companions. They were waiting there at Newark Airport, waiting for the flight to Washington. And he saw them eating sandwiches. He said, "But we're going to dinner. What are you eating?" They said, "When you're invited to the White House, you eat before you go." And that was the rule. And everybody in Washington knew this, apparently, because the food was so dreary, and people would write home and say, "We had dinner at the White House. FDR was charming. Eleanor was so warm and welcoming. But the food!" And they would write back these descriptions of this gray, miserable meat, the soggy vegetables, the ridiculous salads, the pathetic desserts. It was really awful. And the reason that it kept going like that was that Eleanor was very much of two minds about giving in to any of the kind of luxuries and life-enhancing things that was a part of FDR that she just didn't trust. She didn't want him to have a good time and with food or anything else. And that was kind of her approach to it. What we do find out about Eleanor, though, and this kind of redeems her completely, is on her own, outside the doors of the White House, traveling or meeting with her women friends whom she loved, or in the long career that she had after his death, and she went off on her own and had a major public career. The food was great. She enjoyed it. She traveled all over the world. She ate what she wanted. She had a good time. She did have an appetite. She did have a capacity to enjoy food, but it had to be on her own terms with her own people. It was the marriage and the kind of prison of the White House, which it was for her in those years, that clamped down on her appetite and gave her that reputation of being the Puritan who disdained food.
If you're just tuning in, you're listening to In the Moment on SDPB Radio. My guest, Laura Shapiro, the book is called What She Ate, Six Remarkable Women and the Food That Tells Their Story. And Laura, I'm noticing a theme about the men. Let's talk a little bit about the men and these women's lives and how much do they really alter a woman's overall food narrative?
Well, in Eleanor's life, of course, FDR was key. Eva Braun wouldn't have existed without Hitler in her life. Dorothy Wordsworth cooked all the time for the brother she adored, so in many ways she was kind of under the sway of a man. I mean, you're right about this. Helen Gurley Brown had the validation of her husband all the time, but then there was Barbara Pym, this wonderful British novelist, mm-hmm. who made a choice. She grew up in the 30s and lived through, she volunteered during the war and so forth. Then she goes back to London and she decides to become a novelist, something she's been trying to do for many years, but she thinks now she's going to do it seriously. She has had a life full of men and love affairs and wild crushes. It was a very important part of her growing up years. Now she's settling into her chosen profession, and it's incredibly important to her to define herself as a novelist and to make writing the center of her life. And although she never says so, she doesn't put it in these terms. I'm putting it in these terms. She turns her back on a future with men, and she delivers herself to a life of writing with the greatest pleasure. There are plenty of men in her life. In fact, she continues to have crushes on very unavailable men, namely gay men and people she'll never get close to. But she's genuinely and truly married to her life as a novelist, and it is to writing and to fiction that she really gives her best, and the fiction repays her a thousandfold. Mm. It's a beautiful reflection of her time and her moment and who she is. So she's really the only one who doesn't have, you know, what I call the male gaze over her all the time. She's, right. For one thing, she's just so funny, and she has no illusions about men at all. She really thinks so many of them are just windbags and has no trouble having her characters say so at any opportunity. So it's, you know, she does not have this male worship that we see in some of these other women.
I want to finish off our time before we let you go with just a little bit about the introduction of this book, because it is, the introduction alone is so beautifully written, but it's almost impossible to get through it without wanting to pick up a pen and write your own sort of food story, stories about your life with food. That's maybe intentional on your part. Tell us how you feel about just these food stories that might never get told and some of the ways that women might approach this book.
I feel very strongly about exactly what you're saying. I really hope that people finish this book, they will look around their kitchens, look in their refrigerator, look at the plate in front of them, and see what you see about your life there, and see what it tells you, you know, about your growing up, and why you chose this, and why you cook it that way, and do you feel awful because your mother used to make it so much better, and you will never get there, or do you feel great because your mother was a terrible cook and you are so much better? It's all the material of your life. It all counts. And you know what also counts? If you're totally not interested in food, if you forget about that meal the minute it's over, that counts. That is your food story. I wish everybody would just go and write it down. Tell everything about it. Type it into your little personal blog or put it in your papers for your great-great-great-grandchildren to find. They will thank you. They'll know who you are when they read it.
I love it. Laura Shapiro is the author of What She Ate, Six Remarkable Women, and The Food That Tells Their Story. Lots of other books. You can find her at laurashapirowriter.com. We'll put a link up after the show. Laura, thank you so much for your time today, and thank you for this really delightful book.
Thank you for having me.